It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Good afternoon to our listening audience, wherever you may be. I hope you're having a good Saturday. Hopefully this week's edition of Alaska Tracks will make it even better. I'm Randy Zarnke, and I'll be your host for the next half hour. This program shares excerpts from interviews I've recorded with veteran outdoorsmen and women throughout Alaska. Our featured guest for this week's episode is Adam Greenwald of Huna. Adam's family has a long history in that part of southeast Alaska. I won't mention any of the details because I want you to hear it from Adam himself. This first segment is all about the family, how they got started in the Huna area, and how Adam's older brother taught him all about wildlife, hunting, and trapping.
I was born in Huna in 1927, January the 5th, and I was one of a family of 10 sisters and 3 brothers, family of 14 kids and mother and dad. My dad came from Germany, Saarbrücken, Saar Valley, in the late 1800s. He was in Pennsylvania for a while, and then he moved to Pueblo, Colorado, working in a steel mill there. And then his brother came over, and he and his brother decided to go to San Francisco because they were having quite a gold rush into California at the time. So they hiked from Pueblo, Colorado to San Francisco. I've read several times in just recent years where, well, there was a guy that hiked Death Valley and they had motorcade that followed him along, and they figured he was the first man to ever hike Death Valley. And my dad did that with his brother. When they got to San Francisco, the gold rush was going great guns up in Alaska. And my dad got the fever and he wanted to go to Alaska, and his brother Otto decided that he was tired of traveling, decided to stay in San Francisco. And he said, "Bob," that's my dad, he said, "you go to Alaska, and if you strike it rich, we'll keep in contact with each other. You let me know and I'll come up." And so my dad, he got as far as Washington, and he worked in a black diamond mine in Washington till he made enough money to get on a tramp steamer and go to Skagway. He went up over the Dyea Trail and wound up Lake LaBarge. He eventually wound up in Dawson. And he spent 3 years up there. And he had a little grub stake when he went up there, but when he came back, he was flat broke and didn't make a dime. And he wound up in Douglas. The Treadwell Mine was going great guns then. And so he went to work at the Treadwell Mine. And he worked there until just prior to the cave-in of the mine. And he sort of sensed it. He said they were mining out support pillars. And he didn't think that was a good idea. And he decided that he better get out of there. It was a short time after that they had the cave-in. And that was the end of the Treadwell Mine. But anyway, it was during the days that saltries, it was actually prior to the canned salmon. In fact, my grandfather, he came to Alaska, and he had a saltry at Bartlett Cove, right where the Glacier Bay Lodge is now, in Glacier Bay National Park. And then he moved to Port Althorp. In fact, he's buried at Port Althorp, where he died of pneumonia out there. But anyhow, my dad decided that this would be a good place to homestead, and he talked to several superintendents of the saltries and canneries, and that was before the days of refrigeration, so they had no fresh meat. The only meat they had was in cans or salted, like corned beef. So he made a deal with them. If they'd buy beef and chicken and egg and pork from him, he'd raise them. So he homesteaded Spasky, which is only 7 miles from here, across the valley, and he patented 143 acres over there. And we had cattle, we had chickens, we had team horses, we had pigs. He dug himself a great big pit. It was about, say, 20 feet wide and probably about 40 feet long and about 8-10 feet deep. And he scooped it all out with a manure scoop with a team of horses. Then in the wintertime, on the weekends when we weren't in school, he'd have all the kids over there and put snowshoes on, and he'd scoop it full of snow, and we'd tamp it with snowshoes. And he kept that up until he had it mounted 6-7 feet high above the pit, and then he covered it with about a foot of moss. And that was our refrigeration. In July, July and August, late summer, it'd be solid ice down there. It'd be probably half full. And he dug a stairways down in it, and he dug holes in the walls inside, and that's where we'd stick his quarters of beef in the ice. And he'd run from cannery to cannery, taking orders, come back home, and he'd fill the orders on a boat named Mabel G. It was named after my oldest sister. There were two canneries. There was Port Althorp Cannery and Pacific American Fisheries, PAF. And he'd deliver there, and then he'd run to Hawk Inlet and take orders from P.E. Harris there and come back and load up and deliver there. Then he'd run out to Port Althorp, take orders from the cannery out there. That was August Bushman. And his brother had a cannery where now was Petersburg. And that was run by Peter Bushman. That's where Petersburg got the name, was Peter Bushman. So we were busy raising livestock, and we had probably about 20, 25 acres of potatoes. So we furnished sacks of potatoes, and we had rutabagas, we had carrots, we had cabbage, we had a big field of strawberries and a lot of rhubarb, and just about anything you have to grow here, we produced. And during the time of the Depression, as far as we were concerned, the Depression was just a hole in the ground, because we lived high off the hog. We had butter churns, we made our own butter, we had milk cows, we had all the beef we wanted. And in the wintertime, all my brothers trapped, my dad trapped, when the canneries were all shut down, so we spent the winter trapping. And so I sort of grew up with it.
Did you learn from your father or brothers? Is that where you learned how to trap?
I believe I learned more from my older brother, Albert. He was the second oldest one of the family. I'm right back in the middle. I had two brothers older than me and one brother younger than me. So I was pretty much in the middle, but my oldest brother, Albert, was next to the oldest. And he just loved trapping and hunting. I did a lot of hunting with him and trapping with him. And I helped him skin his pelt. I just learned a lot of tricks. And then as you go along, you learn a lot on your own, too.
Do you remember the first traps that you used?
Yeah, I think some of the first ones were probably more precise made, but they weren't quite as good as some of the later ones. Like, there were Newhouse traps, and the Newhouse traps are very precise, but they tend to freeze up a little bit because they're too precise. And the old Victors were sort of a sloppy built thing, but they just flopped open and flopped shut. They didn't freeze up as much. Although trapping otter, that was all Newhouse trap. There was a number 48 Newhouse. I don't think the Victor made them with the teeth on the jaws. They had the one that had an inlay that you could bolt to the jaws and it had teeth on, but you had a lot of fiddling around making them. Where the Newhouse, they had the teeth welded right on the jaws. And for otter, you pretty much had to use the jaws with the teeth on them. Their legs above their paws was just about as big as their paws, all muscle. And you get just a regular trap, a number four, they'd eventually pull out of
them. You remember the first animals you caught?
Yeah, it was mostly mink and weasels. Around the river flats where we lived, there was quite a few weasels. They were sort of an easy one to catch, but they weren't no great numbers. You get away from these river flats in this country, you don't get many of them. It's just around where there's field mice on these river flats. I believe the first animal I ever caught that was a mink, and I was up along Spasky River, and I'd follow my brother along and see how he trapped, and then I'd try to emulate him, and I did wind up catching a few.
And how old were you?
I was probably about 9 or 10 years old when I caught my first animals, you know.
And did you get to keep that money, or did that go into the family?
I guess you could say I kept it, but I went to board buying my school clothes. It made you feel like you did something. Not that I could furnish all my clothes, but I did help. I remember when I bought my first suit of knickerbockers. I was probably about 10 years old then. That was about 1937. I had my first suit. I grew up hunting my older brothers. They teach me how to shoot and how to sight in the gun and how to aim and handle a rifle. Made sure that you never had a loaded gun that was pointing to tag anybody. Always either pointing to the sky or to the ground or away from somebody. And the same with a shotgun. Always had it broken open at a low 12 gauge single shot. And the only time I closed it was when I put a shell in the barrel, and then I was ready to shoot at a bird. I got most of my education from my older brothers.
Is the homestead still in the family?
No, it isn't. My dad sold that to a bookkeeper at Dicey Trace Salmon Company, and my dad worked there for quite a few years, but he closed the farm down because refrigeration came in, they could ship their beef in, and so you couldn't compete, and so he eventually went to work for the company. Then he sold it to a guy by the name of Len McKee. He was a bookkeeper, and he lived in Seattle, and there's nobody there. It's just sitting idle. There's 143 acres there. Beautiful land. I have lots of good memories there, but I still go over and pick wild strawberries there and reminisce. I can remember when I was a kid and when we got all our chores done, we would go up and fish brook trout. It was a little stream and it was only about a foot and a half wide, but it was about a foot and a half deep. It was just a long, narrow, slow-moving little stream. And down the bottom of it, there was these little periwinkles. They looked like twigs, but you peel the bark off and it's a worm inside. And we'd take this beach grass and we'd split it down the middle, and then we'd take one of these here little periwinkles and tie them in the end of the grass. Then we'd lay on our stomachs and we'd lower it down in the stream. As soon as it disappeared, you could flip it back behind you into the grass. If you had your timing perfect, you know, but if about 90% of the time a trout would come out of the water and fall back in again. And they were only about 4 to 5 inches long, small little trout.
There wasn't even a hook.
No, just this worm tied in the grass. It was just a timing, so you could flip them on the bank, and you lost them more often than you got them. One day this big yacht was anchored inside of Palitzio Island, which was right outside of our farm, and the boat name was the Westward. It had been there the year before, and we found out that the person that owned it was George Eastman, Eastman Kodak Company. And him and a group of his friends would go up and trout fish the Spasky River. Anyhow, it happened to be one of the days that we had off, and there was several of my sisters, and I know Robert, my older brother, was there. It was probably about 6-7 of us. And we're fishing these little brook trout. Everybody's screaming and laughing and having a big time. And this group of guys came walking up the flats. And they're about a quarter of a mile from us, and they're hitting for the Spasky River. And they stopped and they kept listening. Pretty soon they turned and came walking over. They come over there and they watched us a while. And next thing you know, they laid their split bamboo rods down. And they're all there was just split grass. And they're laying there catching these brook trout, you know. And they were screaming and laughing just with us and having the biggest time. And we baked trout over the campfire out there, and they sat there and chomped away on these little trout, you know. And when they left, they gave us their split bamboo rods, and that was the first fishing rod I owned in my life. We used willow or olive branches, you know, and tie a string to, and that was our fishing rods. Anyhow, that was millionaires come from California, I guess. Come up here and lay on the bank and fish with grass, you know.
Well, with you folks having all the beef and pigs and all that, deer meat probably wasn't all that crucial, but I imagine you hunted deer.
Well, we like deer meat. You know, my mother was born in Alaska. My grandmother was born in Alaska. Before we ever start raising beef, we ate a lot of venison. And to us, venison would be just a lot like you'd say pork and beef is today. We had quite a variety. My dad was pretty good at putting up sausages. He made his own German sausage. We made blood sausage, and we had a little bit of hams. He smoked hams. So we had a lot of processed meat, too. And that would be before the days of refrigeration, so that we cured a lot of our meat, smoke cured. And then we had a lot of canned.
Do you remember any of the early deer hunts when you were young?
Oh, yeah. I can remember several of them. I can remember one especially that was with my older brother. He did a lot of deer calling, and so did I after I got older, learned how to call them. And he called several times, and they don't always come. And sometimes they do come, they don't come very fast. Well, you got to have patience. And he was calling, and we were along a hillside, and he didn't see anything right away, so he decided to move on. And we started hiking a little, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and I happened to look, and there was a great big windfall up on the hill. And behind this windfall, I could see his deer head sticking up and a big rack of horns on it. It was looking right down at us. I couldn't see the deer, but I could just see his head over this log. I was about maybe 7-8 feet behind my brother, and I was going, psh, like that. And I didn't want to make too much noise because I didn't want to get bawled out. But finally he turned around, he frowned at me, and I pointed up on the hill. So he sort of tippy-toed back, and I said, behind that log, I can see a deer's head. He looked up there. Oh my God, he says it is. And he squatted down and he took a bead up there and squeezed off a shot and it disappeared. We walked up there, hit us right on the end of the nose. Great big buck. And man, I was so proud because maybe 15, 20 minutes before he started calling, he gave me a ball out because I stepped on a twig and it made a little noise. And he said, I'll never take you out again. He said, you make too much noise. You spook everything away. And he kept that up a little bit. And then I kept standing there and said, Albert, good thing you took me with you. You'd never got that deer if I hadn't seen it. And he finally agreed, yeah, he says, you're right. I wouldn't have got it. Boy, I could have busted my buttons. I was a little guy, and I was just as proud as punch, you know.
Doesn't Adam sound just like your favorite uncle? I love listening to his stories. Let's take a break here for a word from our sponsors. Okay, we're back with you. Let's return to more great stories from Adam Greenwald of Hoona. In this next segment, he tells a few hunting and trapping experiences.
One of the scariest time I ever had, and I had several of them trapping in the middle of the winter. One time I had a trap line in Port Frederick Air run from South Bight to Chimney Rock, which sort of runs 90 degrees from the rest of the bay. It's a point that sticks out. And I had a trap line there of mostly mink, and I had a few marten traps. But the weather was so bad, it was blowing northerly wind for a week or 10 days, straight up Port Frederick. And it just pounds on that shore, and there was no way I could even get up with my skiff. And it was bitter down in the teens. And so after about a 10-day stretch, the wind died down one day, and it turned calm and beautiful out. And I told Esther, my wife, I said, I'm going to run up, and I'm going to see if I can get it in and check that trap line. So when I ran up there, there was still a surf washing on the beach along there. So I run out around the other side of Chimney Rock, which is a little bite there and a nice sand beach, and I anchored my skiff out, and I put my pack sack on my back, and I figured I was going to have to spend all day on a trap line that usually takes me maybe an hour to check running with the skiff. I had to hike it, and it was about 2 miles. I had about 30, 40 traps along there, and a lot of them were buried in snow and ice, and I had a number of animals in my trap. When I got back, it was getting late, sort of getting that evening feeling, getting a little dusky. Got back, the skiff was still out there floating fine. I pulled the skiff in, and it started in to blow more northerly again. I better get in a hurry and get going here before it gets too rough. I can't make it home. So I pulled my skiff in, threw my trap gear in and my pack sack, and I jumped in and started up the motor. And I run in the trough right straight across the bay. I was going to head for Seagull Flat and then run down along the southeast side of the bay, and which is a little more protected. And I got about halfway across Port Frederick. The motor started sort of slowing down. I looked back, and I could see smoke coming out, and I took the cover off the motor real quick, like, and I slowed the motor down just to idle. And I could see it sizzling. It was hotter than a firecracker. So I shut it off and I kept turning my flywheel so it wouldn't freeze up on the engine. And I kept turning it and turning it. And finally it cooled off enough. I just left the cover off and I decided, well, I made it from the beach out here. I think I could start up and leave the cover off and make it back to the beach again. So I did. And I made it back to the beach, but it was getting pretty hot. And I got off on the beach. And by that time, it was getting sort of evening, dusky out. So I jerked the motor off the back of the skiff. The north wind started into blowing good again. So I had a 3-pound coffee can for a bailing can in my skiff. I dipped a couple inches of water in it. And then I took and I poured about 2 or 3 cups of gas out of my outboard tank in it. And I threw a match in. I did it many times to warm my hands. You can put gas in and it doesn't get enough oxygen to flame up. So it just smudges. Say 2 cups of gas will burn for pretty near 45 minutes, just smudging in there, and you can keep warm on it. And I had set the can up on the beach. I took my toolbox and I jerked the lower unit off the motor, see what was wrong. What happened was, and I know better, but I goofed. And in my hurry to get to my trap line, when I anchored, I tipped my motor up and pushed the skiff out and anchored it and then took off. Well, it's so cold that the salt water in the water pump, which is on the lower units up out of the water, froze. So when I tipped the motor down and started the engine, it just wiped my impeller out. It was froze solid. It was lucky would have it. It was an old Elgin motor that was handled by Sears Roebuck. And the water pump was a flat piece of pressed tarpaulin cloth in shellac and hardened. Anyhow, it was about 1 inch wide and about 3 inches long. And it was a slot in my drive shaft that this slid through. And the drive shaft was off center in the pump chamber so that it made an eccentric. It made the water pump. Well, they just shut it off so it was 3 pieces in there. So I took my trap hatch and I went up and I chopped off a spruce branch, whittled it down. Then I took my hunting knife and I shaved it down. I cut it off so it just fit in the pump lengthways. And then I kept trying it in my shaft and I kept whittling it down until I got it so it slid through my shaft back and forth. By that time it was getting pretty dark, but I had this little campfire burning in this 3-pound coffee can. But by that time it was cold and the north wind was blowing and I didn't know if I was going to make it home. It was really bad. Put it back together, got on the back of the skiff, and I cranked it up, and the prettiest stream of water you ever seen come out of that back of that motor. So I took off. By the time I got across Port Frederick, it was pitch dark. I knew the shoreline very well and run thousands of times up there. But by the time I got down to Burnt Point, which is about halfway from where I was at to home, I was having to run half speed and the swell clicking over top of me. And so I was barely. If I had taken any grub along, I'd probably pulled in on the lee side of Burnt Point and camped for a while, build a fire. But it was a beautiful day. I was just going to go right up and run back home again. And that didn't happen. But when I made it home, there was ice all over the world. I was knocking ice off. I stopped several times behind islands and took my trapping hatchet and pounded ice off of it. I was just frozen solid. When I got home, she was worried sick. She thought I was dead and gone. But that was one of my scary experiences, and just luck would have it. I had a little luck. The Forest Service is now celebrating their 100th year in Southeast Alaska. In fact, I think in South Central, too, Chugach National Forest and Tongass National Forest. And they're having all their vessels that are still available touring all of Southeast Alaska, and they're going to every port. And I was down the day before yesterday and visited the boat that used to be the Forester, is now named the Sea Bear. And I was on that vessel 58 years ago. The skipper's name was Otter Johnson. And we traveled to all the ports in Southeast Alaska that was either a herring reduction plant, a cannery, or a sawmill that was using water power that was controlled under the U.S. Forest Service. And they had to sign leases and agreements every year. So we went through to all these places and presented them with the new agreements and got their signatures. So I got to see pretty near every port in Southeast Alaska.
Yeah, that must have been real interesting just to travel around to all the different places.
Because the lateness of the summer, they asked me if I wouldn't be willing to go on the vessel in Prince William Sound. And the name of it was the Chugach. And that was the biggest boat they had in Alaska. They gave me a six-month contract. They paid my way up there, and they'd pay my way home at the end of the contract. And I got room and board. So I signed the contract, and I went up. I no more got up there in the town of Hoonah. Burnt down. It was in 1944. My folks had a store here then, and their store burnt down. They lost everything, and I couldn't come down because I would have had to pay my own way down. I had this contract signed, so I stayed. But one of my first trips was to Kodiak on an elk count because they transplanted elk from the Olympic Peninsula to Afognak Island. So we had to go up there, and from Cordova, we run out to Kodiak. We picked up some fish and wildlife agents that did the actual elk count, and we went to Raspberry Straits and a couple other little ports, and I think it was two herds of elk at that time. I can't remember how many elk they counted, but they had increased 8 or 9% from the year before. When we were going to leave Kodiak, and them days you had to clear in and out of port. So we went to clear out of port, and they said, no, you can't leave. And the skipper asked them, well, when can we leave? And they said, we'll notify you. You just go back aboard your vessel, and we'll notify you. And we waited that night and the next day, and he got a little hut around the collar, went up and asked him again, and he said, well, I got to get going. They said, well, you just don't go. We'll tell you when you can go. That afternoon, they came down and said, yeah, you can go, as long as you're going east. You can't go west, but you can go east. Well, we were going east. We were going back to Cordova. We found out afterwards that President Roosevelt was on a convoy, and he's cruising the Aleutian Islands. And he was passing Kodiak at the time with the armada that was heading out the Aleutians. But that was deep, dark sea. They didn't tell you any of this. They just tell you, you stay in port till we tell you you can go. And that was the days that they were transplanting a lot of different animals, and one of them was the marten to Chichikov Island. There was no marten here. And prior to that, it was probably 30 years or so before that, they had planted squirrels on the island with the intention of planting marten, and figured that squirrels would be feed for the marten. And it was probably close to 30 years later they did plant the marten. I don't know the exact date when they first planted them, but it was in the early to mid-40s, and it was in the 50s when we finally opened up a season on that we could take marten. I remember when I got my first marten in the trap, I didn't even know for sure what it was.
And you mentioned something about color variation. They weren't all that uniform at the beginning.
Right. They had set out bids on marten to trappers. As long as they weren't damaged, they were paying a pretty fair price. Well, they got marten from the interior, they got marten from the coast, and they got marten from different parts of the country. And when they transplanted them, there was quite a variation in color. I caught some of my early marten that was solid orange. The prettiest thing you ever seen. They didn't pay a big price for them, but they were sure a beautiful animal. They settle down now to a pretty uniform color. They're pretty much dark brown, and the tip of the ears is gray. But when I first started trapping, it was rainbow colors. the worst picture of fur you ever seen. But they did settle down so now that very seldom get an orange or a different colored mark. I caught one marten, and Norman Goldberg was buying it. In fact, he's sitting right here in my living room, and he was tossing the marten on the floor. He sorted him by size and colors. He took this one, and he set it over on the side, and they kept on going through the marten. When he got through, he reached over and grabbed this one marten, and he said, "Where'd you catch this?" And I couldn't tell you exactly where I caught it, but it was someplace in Port Frederick. And I said, "Why is that?" He says, "In all my furs that I bought in Southeast Alaska, this is the closest I've ever seen to a Russian sable." And he showed it to me, and about every quarter of an inch or so, there was a silver, fine, grayish hair. Didn't notice until you look real close. It gives a gloss to it. It was a real dark brown, but it had these little silver hairs all through it. And he says, "That's typical of Russian sable."
Did he give you an extra special price on it?
He gave me a good price on it, but it wasn't a lot more than the rest. That I thought was strange to have one animal out of about 100 of them. And that was the only one I ever caught that he said looked typical of Russian sable.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode. If you enjoyed listening to Adam, please tune in again next week at this time for a second program filled with his great adventures.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.